give comments about their appearance. Pay for the meal. Do not mention sex. Gene walked to the door, then turned back. What about the paper ones? I gave him my questionnaires from Table for Eight, the singles party, and, at his insistence, even the partially completed ones from the speed dating. Now it was out of my hands. Chapter 6. Approximately 2 hours after Jean left my office with the completed wife project questionnaires, there was a knock on the door. I was weighing student essays, an activity that is not forbidden, but I suspect only because nobody is aware that I'm doing it. It was part of a project to reduce the effort of assessment by looking for easily measured parameters such as the inclusion of a table of contents or a typed versus handwritten cover sheet, factors which might provide as good an indication of quality as the tedious process of reading the entire assignment. I slipped the scales under my desk as the door opened and looked up to see a woman I did not recognize standing in the doorway. I estimated her age as 30 and her body mass index at 20. Professor Tillman. As my name is on the door, this was not a particularly astute question. Correct. Professor Barrow suggested I see you. I was amazed at Jean's efficiency and looked at the woman more carefully as she approached my desk. There were no obvious signs of unsuitability. I did not detect any makeup. Her body shape and skin tone were consistent with health and fitness. She wore glasses with heavy frames that revived bad memories of Apricot Ice Cream Woman, a long black T-shirt that was torn in several places, and a black belt with metal chains. It was lucky that the jewellery question had been deleted because she was wearing big metal earrings and an interesting pendant around her neck. Although I'm usually oblivious to dress, hers seemed incompatible with my expectation of a highly qualified academic or professional, and with the summer weather. I could only guess that she was self-employed or on holiday and, freed from workplace rules, had chosen her clothes randomly. I could relate to this. There had been quite a long gap since either of us spoke, and I realized it must be my turn. I looked up from the pendant and remembered Jean's instructions. How about we do dinner tonight? She seemed surprised at my question, then replied, Yeah, right. How about we do dinner? How about Le Gavroche and your paying? Excellent. I'll make a reservation for 8 p.m. You're kidding. It was an odd response. Why would I make a confusing joke with someone I barely knew? No, is 8 p.m. tonight acceptable? Let me get this straight. You're offering to buy me dinner at Le Gavroche tonight. Coming on top of the question about my name, I was beginning to think that this woman was what Jean would call not the sharpest tool in the shed. I considered backing out or at least employing some delaying tactic until I could check her questionnaire, but could not think of any socially acceptable way to do this, so I just confirmed that she had interpreted my offer correctly. She turned and left, and I realized that I did not even know her name. I called Jean immediately. There seemed to be some confusion on his part at first, followed by mirth. Perhaps he had not expected me to handle the candidate so effectively. "Her name's Rosie," he said. "And that's all I'm telling you. Have fun, and remember what I said about sex." Jean's failure to provide me with more details was unfortunate, because a problem arose. Le Gavroche did not have a table available at the agreed time. I tried to locate Rosie's profile on my computer, and for once the photos were useful. The woman who had come to my office did not look like any candidate whose name began with R. She must have been one of the paper responses. Jean had left and his phone was off. I was forced to take action that was not strictly illegal, but doubtless immoral. I justified it on the basis that it would be more immoral to fail to meet my commitment to Rosie. Le Gavroche's online reservation system had a facility for VIPs, and I made a reservation under the name of the Dean after logging on using relatively unsophisticated hacking software. I arrived at 7:59 p.m. The restaurant was located in a major hotel. I chained my bike in the foyer as it was raining heavily outside. Fortunately, it was not cold and my Gore-Tex jacket had done an excellent job of protecting me. My T-shirt was not even damp underneath. A man in uniform approached me. He pointed towards the bike, but I spoke before he had a chance to complain. "My name is Professor Lawrence and I interacted with your reservation system at 5:11 p.m. It appeared that the official did not know the dean or assumed that I was another Professor Lawrence because he just checked a clipboard and nodded. I was impressed with the efficiency, though it was now 8:01 p.m. and Rosie was not there. Perhaps she was B, a little early, and already seated. But then a problem arose.
"I'm sorry, sir, but we have a dress code," said the official. I knew about this. It was in bold type on the website. Gentlemen are required to wear a jacket.
No jacket, no food, correct?
More or less, sir.
What can I say about this sort of rule? I was prepared to keep my jacket on throughout the meal. The restaurant would presumably be air-conditioned to a temperature compatible with the requirement. I continued towards the restaurant entrance, but the official blocked my path.
"I'm sorry, perhaps I wasn't clear. You need to wear a jacket."
"I'm wearing a jacket."
"I'm afraid we require something a little more formal, sir." The hotel employee indicated his own jacket as an example. In defence of what followed, I submit the Oxford English Dictionary, compact, second edition, definition of jacket, 1A, an outer garment for the upper part of the body. I also note that the word jacket appears on the care instructions for my relatively new and perfectly clean Gore-Tex jacket. But it seemed his definition of jacket was limited to conventional suit jacket.
"We would be happy to lend you one, sir, in this style."
"You have a supply of jackets in every possible size." I did not add that the need to maintain such an inventory was surely evidence of their failure to communicate the rule clearly, and that it would be more efficient to improve their wording or abandon the rule altogether. Nor did I mention that the cost of jacket purchase and cleaning must add to the price of their meals. Did their customers know that they were subsidizing a jacket warehouse?
"I wouldn't know about that, sir," he said. "Let me organize a jacket."
Needless to say, I was uncomfortable at the idea of being redressed in an item of public clothing of dubious cleanliness. For a few moments, I was overwhelmed by the sheer unreasonableness of the situation. I was already under stress, preparing for the second encounter with a woman who might become my life partner. And now the institution that I was paying to supply us with a meal, the service provider, who should surely be doing everything possible to make me comfortable, was putting arbitrary obstacles in my way. My Gore-Tex jacket, the high-technology garment that had protected me in rain and snowstorms, was being irrationally, unfairly, and obstructively contrasted with the official's essentially decorative woolen equivalent. I had paid $1,015 for it, including $120 extra for the customized reflective yellow. I outlined my argument. "My jacket is superior to yours by all reasonable criteria. Impermeability to water, visibility in low light, storage capacity." I unzipped the jacket to display the internal pockets and continued. "Speed of drying, resistance to food stains, hood..." The official was still showing no interpretable reaction, although I had almost certainly raised my voice. "Vastly superior tensile strength." To illustrate this last point, I took the lapel of the employee's jacket in my hands. I obviously had no intention of tearing it, but I was suddenly grabbed from behind by an unknown person who attempted to throw me to the ground. I automatically responded with a safe, low-impact throw to disable him without dislodging my glasses. The term low-impact applies to a martial arts practitioner who knows how to fall. This person did not, and landed heavily. I turned to see him. He was large and angry. In order to prevent further violence, I was forced to sit on him.
"Get the fuck off me, I'll fucking kill you," he said.
On that basis, it seemed illogical to grant his request. At that point, another man arrived and tried to drag me off. Concerned that thug number one would carry out his threat, I had no choice but to disable thug number two as well. No one was seriously hurt, but it was a very awkward social situation, and I could feel my mind shutting down. Fortunately, Rosie arrived. Jacket Man said, apparently in surprise, "Rosie." Obviously, he knew her. She looked from him to me and said, "Professor Tillman, Don, what's going on?" "You're late," I said. "We have a social problem."
"You know this man?" said Jacket Man to Rosie.
"What do you think? I guessed his name?" Rosie sounded belligerent, and I thought this might not be the best approach. Surely we should seek to apologize and leave. I was assuming we would not now be eating in the restaurant. A small crowd had arrived, and it occurred to me that another thug might arrive, so I needed to work out a way of freeing up a hand without releasing the original two thugs. In the process, one poked the other in the eye, and their anger levels increased noticeably. Jacket Man added, "He assaulted Jason." Rosie replied, "Right, poor Jason, always the victim." I could now see her. She was wearing a black dress without decoration, thick-soled black boots, and vast amounts of silver jewellery on her arms. Her red hair was spiky, like some new species of cactus. I've heard the word stunning used to describe women, but this was the first time I'd actually been stunned by one. It was not just the costume or the jewellery or any individual characteristic of Rosie herself. It was their combined effect. I was not sure if her appearance would be regarded as conventionally beautiful or even acceptable to the restaurant that had rejected my jacket. Stunning was the perfect word for it. But what she did was even more stunning. She took her phone from her bag and pointed at us. It flashed twice. Jacket Man moved to take it from her. "Don't you fucking think about it," Rosie said. "I'm going to have so much fun with these photos that these guys will never stand on a door again. Professor teaches bouncers a lesson." As Rosie was speaking, a man in a chef's hat arrived. He spoke briefly to Jacket Man and Rosie, and on the basis that we would be permitted to leave without further harassment, Rosie asked me to release my assailants. We all got to our feet, and in keeping with tradition, I bowed, then extended my hand to the two men, who I had concluded must be security personnel. They'd only been doing what they were paid for and had risked injury in the course of their duties. It seemed that they were not expecting the formalities, but then one of them laughed and shook my hand, and the other followed his example. It was a good resolution, but I no longer felt like eating at the restaurant. I collected my bike and we walked into the street. I expected Rosie to be angry about the incident, but she was smiling. I asked her how she knew Jacket Man. "Oh, I used to work there." "You selected the restaurant because you were familiar with it." "You could say that. I wanted to stick it up him." She began to laugh. "Maybe not quite that much." I told her that her solution was brilliant. "I work in a bar," she said. "Not just a bar, the Marquis of Queensbury. I deal with jerks for a living." I pointed out that if she had arrived on schedule, she could have used her social skills and the violence would have been unnecessary. "Glad I was late then. That was judo, right?" "Aikido." As we crossed the road, I switched my bike to my other side between Rosie and me. "I'm also proficient in karate, but Aikido was more appropriate." "No way. It takes forever to learn that stuff, doesn't it?" "I commenced at 7. "How often do you train?" 3 times per week, except in the case of illness, public holidays, and travel to overseas conferences." "What got you into it?" asked Rosie. I pointed to my glasses. "Revenge of the nerds," she said. "This is the first time I've required it for self-defense since I was at school. It's primarily for fitness." I had relaxed a little, and Rosie had provided an opportunity to slip in a question from the Wife Project questionnaire. "Do you exercise regularly?"
"Depends what you call regularly," she laughed. "I'm the unfittest person on the planet."
"Exercise is extremely important for maintaining health." "So my dad tells me. He's a personal trainer. Constantly on my case. He gave me a gym membership for my birthday. At his gym. He has this idea we should train for a triathlon together." "Surely you should follow his advice," I said.
"Fuck. I'm almost 30. I don't need my dad telling me what to do."
She changed the subject. "Listen, I'm starving. Let's get a pizza." I was not prepared to consider a restaurant after the preceding trauma. I told her that I intended to revert to my original plan for the evening, which was cooking at home.
"Got enough for two?" she asked.
"You still owe me dinner."
This was true, but there had been too many unscheduled events already in my day.
"Come on, I won't criticize your cooking. I can't cook to save my life." I was not concerned about my cooking being criticized, but the lack of cooking skills on her part was the third fault so far in terms of the Wife Project questionnaire, after the late arrival and the lack of fitness. There was almost certainly a fourth. It was unlikely that her profession as a waitress and barmaid was consistent with the specified intellectual level. There was no point in continuing. Before I could protest, Rosie had flagged down a minivan taxi with sufficient capacity for my bike. Where do you live? She asked.
Chapter 7. Wow, Mr. Neat. How come there are no pictures on the walls? I had not had visitors since Daphne moved out of the building. I knew that I only needed to put out an extra plate and cutlery, but it had already been a stressful evening, and the adrenaline-induced euphoria that had immediately followed the jacket incident had evaporated, at least on my part. Rosie seemed to be in a permanently manic state. We were in the living area, which adjoins the kitchen, because after a while I would stop noticing them. The human brain is wired to focus on differences in its environment, so it can rapidly discern a predator. If I installed pictures or other decorative objects, I would notice them for a few days, and then my brain would ignore them. If I want to see art, I go to the gallery. The paintings there are of higher quality, and the total expenditure over time is less than the purchase price of cheap posters. In fact, I had not been to an art gallery since the 10th of May, 3 years before. But this information would weaken my argument, and I saw no reason to share it with Rosie and open up other aspects of my personal life to interrogation. Rosie had moved on and was now examining my CD collection. The investigation was becoming annoying. Dinner was already late. "You really love Bach," she said. This was a reasonable deduction, as my CD collection consists only of the works of that composer, but it was not correct. I decided to focus on Bach after reading Gödel, Escher, Bach by Douglas Hofstadter. Unfortunately, I haven't made much progress. I don't think my brain works fast enough to decode the patterns in the music. You don't listen to it for fun. This was beginning to sound like the initial dinner conversations with Daphne, and I didn't answer. You've got an iPhone, she said. Well, of course, but I don't use it for music. I download podcasts. Let me guess, on genetics? Science in general. I moved to the kitchen to begin dinner preparation, and Rosie followed me, stopping to look at my whiteboard schedule. Wow, she said again. This reaction was becoming predictable. I wondered what her response to DNA or evolution would be. I commenced retrieval of vegetables and herbs from the refrigerator. Let me help, she said. I can chop or something. The implication was that chopping could be done by an inexperienced person unfamiliar with the recipe. After her comment that she was unable to cook, even in a life-threatening situation, I had visions of huge chunks of leek and fragments of herbs too fine to sieve out. No assistance is required, I said. I recommend reading a book. I watched Rosie walk to the bookshelf, briefly peruse the contents, then walk away. Perhaps she used IBM rather than Mac software, although many of the manuals applied to both. The sound system has an iPod port that I use to play podcasts while I cook. Rosie plugged in her phone, and music emanated from the speakers. It was not loud, but I was certain that if I had put on a podcast without asking permission when visiting someone's house, I would have been accused of a social error. Very certain, as I had made this exact mistake at a dinner party 4 years and 67 days ago. Rosie continued her exploration like an animal in a new environment, which of course was what she was. She opened the blinds and raised them, creating some dust. I consider myself fastidious in my cleaning, but I do not need to open the blinds, and there must have been dust in places not reachable without doing so. Behind the blinds are doors, and Rosie released the bolts and opened them. I was feeling very uncomfortable at this violation of my personal environment. I tried to concentrate on food preparation as Rosie stepped out of sight onto the balcony. I could hear her dragging the two big pot plants, which presumably were dead after all these years. I put the herb and vegetable mixture in the large saucepan with the water, salt, rice wine vinegar, mirin, orange peel and coriander seeds. I don't know what you're cooking, Rosie called out, but I'm basically vegetarian. Vegetarian. I had already commenced cooking, based on ingredients purchased on the assumption that I would be eating alone. And what did basically mean? Did it imply some limited level of flexibility, like my colleague Esther, who admitted only under rigorous questioning that she would eat pork if necessary to survive? Vegetarians and vegans can be incredibly annoying. Jean has a joke. How can you tell if someone is a vegan? Just wait 10 minutes and they'll tell you. If this was so, it would not be so much of a problem. No, vegetarians arrive for dinner and then say, I don't eat meat. This was the second time.
The Pig's Trotter disaster happened 6 years ago, when Jean suggested that I invite a woman to dinner at my apartment. He argued that my cooking expertise would make me more desirable, and I would not have to deal with the pressure of a restaurant environment.
And you can drink as much as you like and stagger to the bedroom.
The woman's name was Bethany, and her internet profile did not mention vegetarianism. Realizing that the quality of the meal would be critical, I borrowed a recently published book of nose-to-tail recipes from the library and planned a multi-course meal featuring various parts of the animal. Brains, tongue, mesentery, pancreas, kidneys, etc. Bethany arrived on time and seemed very pleasant. We had a glass of wine and then things went downhill. We started with fried pig's trotter, which had been quite complex to prepare, and Bethany ate very little of hers.
"I'm not big on pig's trotters," she said.
This was not entirely unreasonable. We all have preferences, and perhaps she was concerned about fat and cholesterol. But when I outlined the courses to follow, she declared herself to be a vegetarian. Unbelievable. She offered to buy dinner at a restaurant, but having spent so much time in preparation, I did not want to abandon the food. I ate alone and did not see Bethany again. Now Rosie. In this case, it might be a good thing. Rosie could leave and life would return to normal. She had obviously not filled in the questionnaire honestly, or Jean had made an error. Or possibly he had selected her for her high level of sexual attractiveness, imposing his own preferences on me. Rosie came back inside, looking at me as if expecting a response. "Seafood's okay," she said, "if it's sustainable." I had mixed feelings. It is always satisfying to have the solution to a problem, but now Rosie would be staying for dinner. I walked to the bathroom and Rosie followed. I picked up the lobster from the bath where it had been crawling around.
"Oh, shit," said Rosie.
"You don't like lobster?" I carried it back to the kitchen.
"Oh, I love lobster, but..."
The problem was now obvious, and I could sympathize. You find the killing process unpleasant. Agreed. I put the lobster in the freezer and explained to Rosie that I had researched lobster execution methods, and the freezer method was considered the most humane. I gave her a website reference. While the lobster died, Rosie continued her sniffing around. She opened the pantry and seemed impressed with its level of organization. One shelf for each day of the week, plus storage spaces for common resources, alcohol, breakfast, etc., and stock data on the back of the door.
"You want to come and sort out my place? You want to implement the standardized meal system?"
Despite its substantial advantages, most people consider it odd.
"Just cleaning out the refrigerator would do," she said. "I'm guessing you want Tuesday's ingredients."
I informed her that, as today was Tuesday, no guessing was required. She handed me the nori sheets and bonito flakes. I requested macadamia nut oil, sea salt, and the pepper grinder from the common resources area. "Chinese rice wine," I added, "filed under alcohol."
"Naturally," said Rosie.
She passed me the wine, then began looking at the other bottles in the alcohol section. I purchased my wine in half bottles.
"So you cook this same meal every Tuesday, right?"
"Correct. I listed the 8 major advantages of the standardized meal system. 1. No need to accumulate recipe books. 2. Standard shopping list, hence very efficient shopping. 3. Almost zero waste, nothing in the refrigerator or pantry unless required for one of the recipes. 4. Diet planned and nutritionally balanced in advance. 5. No time wasted wondering what to cook. 6. No mistakes, no unpleasant surprises. 7. Excellent food, superior to most restaurants at a much lower price, see point 3. 8. Minimal cognitive load required.
Cognitive load?
The cooking procedures are in my cerebellum. Virtually no conscious effort is required.
Like riding a bike?
Correct. You can make lobster, whatever, without thinking.
Lobster, mango and avocado salad with wasabi-coated flying fish roe and crispy seaweed and deep-fried leek garnish.
Correct. My current project is quail boning. It still requires conscious effort. Rosie was laughing. It brought back memories of school days. Good ones. As I retrieved additional ingredients for the dressing from the refrigerator, Rosie brushed past me with 2 half bottles of Chablis and put them in the freezer with the lobster.
"Our dinner seems to have stopped moving." Further time is required to be certain of death, I said. Unfortunately, the jacket incident has disrupted the preparation schedule. All times will need to be recalculated. I realized at this point that I should have put the lobster in the freezer as soon as we arrived home, but my brain had been overloaded by the problems created by Rosie's presence. I went to the whiteboard and started writing up revised preparation times. Rosie was examining the ingredients. You were going to eat all this by yourself? I had not revised the standardized meal system since Daphne's departure, and now ate the lobster salad by myself on Tuesdays, deleting the wine to compensate for the additional calorie intake. The quantity is sufficient for two, I said. The recipe can't be scaled down. It's infeasible to purchase a fraction of a live lobster. I had intended the last part as a mild joke, and Rosie reacted by laughing. I had another unexpected moment of feeling good as I continued recalculating times. Rosie interrupted again. If you were on your usual schedule, what time would it be now? 6:38 p.m. The clock on the oven showed 9:09 p.m. Rosie located the controls and started adjusting the time. I realized what she was doing. A perfect solution. When she was finished, it showed 6:38 p.m. No recalculations required. I congratulated her on her thinking. You've created a new time zone. Dinner will be ready at 8:55 p.m. Rosie time. Beats doing the math, she said. Her observation gave me an opportunity for another wife project question. Do you find mathematics difficult? She laughed. It's only the single hardest part of what I do drives me nuts. If the simple arithmetic of bar and restaurant bills was beyond her, it was hard to imagine how we could have meaningful discussions. Where do you hide the corkscrew? She asked. Wine is not scheduled for Tuesdays. Fuck that, said Rosie. There was a certain logic underlying Rosie's response. I would only be eating a single serve of dinner. It was the final step in the abandonment of the evening schedule. I announced the change. Time has been redefined. Previous rules no longer apply. Alcohol is hereby declared mandatory in the Rosie time zone. Chapter 8. As I completed dinner preparation, Rosie set the table. Not the conventional dining table in the living room, but a makeshift table on the balcony, created by taking a whiteboard from the kitchen wall and placing it on top of the two big plant pots, from which the dead plants had been removed. A white sheet from the linen cupboard had been added in the roll of tablecloth. Silver cutlery, a housewarming gift from my parents that had never been used, and the decorative wine glasses were on the table. She was destroying my apartment. It had never occurred to me to eat on the balcony. The rain from early in the evening had cleared when I came outside with the food, and I estimated the temperature at 22 degrees. "Do we have to eat right away?" asked Rosie, an odd question, since she had claimed that she was starving some hours ago. "No, it won't get cold. It's already cold." I was conscious of sounding awkward. "Is there some reason to delay?" "The city lights. The view's amazing." "Unfortunately, it's static. Once you've examined it, there's no reason to look again, like paintings."
"But it changes all the time. What about in the early morning or when it rains? What about coming up here just to sit?"
I had no answer that was likely to satisfy her. I'd seen the view when I bought the apartment. It did not change much in different conditions, and the only times I just sat there were when I was waiting for an appointment or if I was reflecting on a problem, in which case interesting surroundings would be a distraction. I moved into the space beside Rosie and refilled her glass. She smiled. She was almost certainly wearing lipstick. I attempt to produce a standard, repeatable meal, but obviously ingredients vary in their quality from week to week. Today seemed to be of unusually high standard. The lobster salad had never tasted so good. I remembered the basic rule of asking a woman to talk about herself. Rosie had already raised the topic of dealing with difficult customers in a bar, so I asked her to elaborate. This was an excellent move. She had a number of hilarious stories, and I noted some interpersonal techniques for possible future use. We finished the lobster. Then Rosie opened her bag and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. How can I convey my horror? Smoking is not only unhealthy in itself and dangerous to others in the vicinity. It is a clear indication of an irrational approach to life.
There was a good reason for it being the first item on my questionnaire. Rosie must have noticed my shock. Relax, we're outside. There was no point in arguing. I would not be seeing her again after tonight. The lighter flamed, and she held it to the cigarette between her artificially red lips. Anyhow, I've got a genetics question, she said. Proceed. I was back in the world I knew. Someone told me you can tell if a person's monogamous by the size of their testicles. The sexual aspects of biology regularly feature in the popular press, so this was not as stupid a statement as it might appear, although it embodied a typical misconception. It occurred to me that it could be some sort of code for a sexual advance, but I decided to play safe and respond to the question literally. Ridiculous, I said. Rosie seemed very pleased with my answer. You're a star, she said. I've just won a bet. I proceeded to elaborate and noted that Rosie's expression of satisfaction faded. I guessed that she had oversimplified her question and that my more detailed explanation was in fact what she had been told. There may be some correlation at the individual level, but the rule applies to species. Homo sapiens are basically monogamous, but tactically unfaithful. Males benefit from impregnating as many females as possible, but are able to support only one set of offspring. Females seek maximum quality genes for their children, plus a male to support them. I was just settling into the familiar role of lecturer when Rosie interrupted. What about the testicles? Bigger testicles produce more semen. Monogamous species require only sufficient for their mate. Humans need extra to take advantage of random opportunities and to attack the sperm of recent intruders. Nice, said Rosie. Not really. The behavior evolved in the ancestral environment. The modern world requires additional rules. Yeah, said Rosie, like being there for your kids. Correct. But instincts are incredibly powerful. Tell me about it, said Rosie. I began to explain. Instinct is an expression of rhetorical question, said Rosie. I've lived it. My mother went gene shopping at her medical graduation party. These behaviors are unconscious. People don't deliberately... I get that. I doubted it. Non-professionals frequently misinterpret the findings of evolutionary psychology, but the story was interesting. You're saying your mother engaged in unprotected sex outside her primary relationship. With some other student, replied Rosie, while she was dating my... At this point, Rosie raised her hands and made a downwards movement twice with the index and middle fingers of both hands. Father. My real dad's a doctor. I just... don't know which one. Really, really pisses me off. I was fascinated by the hand movements and silent for a while as I tried to work them out. Were they a sign of distress at not knowing who her father was? If so, it was not one I was familiar with. And why had she chosen to punctuate her speech at that point? Of course. Punctuation. Quotation marks, I said aloud as the idea hit me. What? You made quotation marks around father to draw attention to the fact that the word should not be interpreted in the usual way. Very clever. Well, there you go, she said. And there I was thinking you were reflecting on my minor problem with my whole fucking life and might have something intelligent to say. I corrected her. It's not a minor problem at all. I pointed my finger in the air to indicate an exclamation mark. You should insist on being informed. I stabbed the same finger to indicate a full stop. This was quite fun. My mother's dead. She died in a car accident when I was 10. She never told anyone who my father was, not even Phil. Phil? I couldn't think of how to indicate a question mark and decided to drop the game temporarily. This was no time for experimentation. My, hands up, fingers wiggled, father, who'd go apeshit if I told him I wanted to know. Rosie drank the remaining wine in her glass and refilled it. The second half bottle was now empty. Her story was sad, but not uncommon. Although my parents continued to make routine ritual contact, it was my assessment that they had lost interest in me some years ago. Their duty had been completed when I was able to support myself. Her situation was somewhat different, however, as it involved a stepfather. I offered a genetic interpretation. His behavior is completely predictable. You don't have his genes. Male lions kill the cubs from previous matings when they take over a pride. Thanks for that information. I can recommend some further reading if you are interested. You seem quite intelligent for a barmaid. The compliments just keep on coming. It seemed I was doing well, and I allowed myself a moment of satisfaction, which I shared with Rosie.
Excellent. I'm not proficient at dating. There are so many rules to remember.
You're doing okay, she said, except for staring at my boobs.
This was disappointing feedback. Rosie's dress was quite revealing, but I'd been working hard to maintain eye contact.
I was just examining your pendant, I said. It's extremely interesting.
Rosie immediately covered it with her hand.
What's on it?
An image of Isis with an inscription, Sum omnia quae fuerunt suntque eruntque ego. I am all that has been, is, and will be.
I hoped I'd read the Latin correctly. The writing was very small. Rosie seemed impressed.
What about the pendant I had on this morning? Dagger with 3 small red stones and 4 white ones.
Rosie finished her wine. She seemed to be thinking about something. It turned out not to be anything profound.
Want to get another bottle?
I was a little stunned. We had already drunk the recommended maximum amount. On the other hand, she smoked, so obviously she had a careless attitude to health.
You want more alcohol?
Correct, she said in an odd voice. She may have been mimicking me.
I went to the kitchen to select another bottle, deciding to reduce the next day's alcohol intake to compensate. Then I saw the clock. 11:40 p.m.
I picked up the phone and ordered a taxi. With any luck, it would arrive before the after-midnight tariff commenced. I opened a half-bottle of Shiraz to drink while we waited. Rosie wanted to continue the conversation about her biological father.
Do you think there might be some sort of genetic motivation that is built into us to want to know who our parents are?
It's critical for parents to be able to recognize their own children so they can protect the carriers of their genes. Small children need to be able to locate their parents to get that protection.
Maybe it's some sort of carryover from that.
It seems unlikely, but possible. Our behavior is strongly affected by instinct.
So you said, whatever it is that eats me up messes with my head.
Why don't you ask the candidates?
Dear doctor, are you my father? I don't think so.
An obvious thought occurred to me, obvious because I'm a geneticist.
Your hair is a very unusual color, possibly, she laughed.
There aren't any genes for this shade of red. She must have seen that I was confused.
This color only comes out of a bottle?
I realized what she was saying. She had deliberately dyed her hair an unnaturally bright color. Incredible. It hadn't even occurred to me to include hair dyeing on the questionnaire. I made a mental note to do so. The doorbell buzzed. I had not mentioned the taxi to her, so brought her up to date with my plan. She quickly finished her wine, then stuck out her hand, and it seemed to me that I was not the only one feeling awkward.
Well, she said, it's been an evening. Have a good life.
It was a non-standard way of saying good night. I thought it safer to stick with convention.
Good night. I've really enjoyed this evening. I added, good luck finding your father, to the formula.
Thanks.
Then she left.
I was agitated, but not in a bad way. It was more a case of sensory overload. I was pleased to find some wine left in the bottle. I poured it into my glass and phoned Jean. Claudia answered, and I dispensed with pleasantries.
I need to speak with Jean.
He's not home, said Claudia.
She sounded disoriented.
Perhaps she'd been drinking.
I thought he was having lobster with you.
Jean sent me the world's most incompatible woman, a barmaid, late, vegetarian, disorganized, irrational, unhealthy, smoker, psychological problems, can't cook, mathematically incompetent, unnatural hair color. I presume he was making a joke.
Claudia must have interpreted this as a statement of distress because she said,
Are you all right, Don?
Of course, I said. She was highly entertaining, but totally unsuitable for the wife project.
As I said these words, indisputably factual, I felt a twinge of regret at odds with my intellectual assessment. Claudia interrupted my attempt to reconcile the conflicting brain states.
Don, do you know what time it is?
I wasn't wearing a watch. And then I realized my error.
I had used the kitchen clock as my reference when phoning the taxi, the clock that Rosie had reset. It must have been almost 2:30 a.m. How could I have lost track of time like that? It was a severe lesson in the dangers of messing with the schedule. Rosie would be paying the after-midnight tariff in the taxi. I let Claudia return to sleep. As I picked up the 2 plates and 2 glasses to bring them inside, I looked again at the nighttime view of the city, the view I'd never seen before, even though it had been there all the time. I decided to skip my pre-bed Aikido routine and to leave the makeshift table in place. Chapter 9.
I threw her in as a wild card, said Jean when I woke him up from the unscheduled sleep he was taking under his desk the next day. Jean looked terrible, and I told him he should refrain from staying up so late, although for once I'd been guilty of the same error. It was important that he eat lunch at the correct time to get his circadian rhythm back on schedule. He had a packed lunch from home, and we headed for a grassy area in the university grounds. I collected seaweed salad, miso soup, and an apple from the Japanese cafe on the way. It was a fine day. Unfortunately, this meant that there were a number of females in brief clothing sitting on the grass and walking by to distract Jean. Jean is 56 years old, although that information is not supposed to be disclosed. At that age, his testosterone should have fallen to a level where his sex drive was significantly reduced. It is my theory that his unusually high focus on sex is due to mental habit, but human physiology varies and he may be an exception. Conversely, I think Jean believes I have abnormally low sex drive. This is not true. Rather, I am not as skilled as Jean in expressing it in a socially appropriate way. My occasional attempts to imitate Jean have been unsuccessful in the extreme. We found a bench to sit on, and Jean commenced his explanation. She's someone I know, he said. No questionnaire. No questionnaire. This explained the smoking. In fact, it explained everything. Jean had reverted to the inefficient practice of recommending acquaintances for dates. My expression must have conveyed my annoyance. You're wasting your time with the questionnaire. You'd be better off measuring the length of their earlobes. Sexual attraction is Jean's area of expertise. There's a correlation, I asked. People with long earlobes are more likely to choose partners with long earlobes. It's a better predictor than IQ. This was incredible. But much behavior that developed in the ancestral environment seems incredible when considered in the context of the current world. Evolution has not kept up, but earlobes. Could there be a more irrational basis for a relationship? No wonder marriages fail. So, did you have fun? Asked Jean. I informed him that his question was irrelevant. My goal was to find a partner, and Rosie was patently unsuitable. Jean had caused me to waste an evening. But did you have fun? He repeated. Did he expect a different answer to the same question? To be fair, I had not given him a proper answer, but for a good reason. I had not had time to reflect on the evening and determine a proper response. I guessed that fun was going to be an oversimplification of a very complex experience. I provided Jean with a summary of events. As I related the story of the dinner on the balcony, Jean interrupted. If you see her again, there is zero reason for me to see her again. If you see her again, Jean continued, it's probably not a good idea to mention the wife project, since she didn't measure up. Ignoring the incorrect assumption about seeing Rosie again, this seemed like good advice. At that point, the conversation changed direction dramatically, and I did not have an opportunity to find out how Jean had met Rosie. The reason for the change was Jean's sandwich. He took a bite, then called out in pain and snatched my water bottle. Oh, shit! Oh, shit! Claudia put chilies in my sandwich! It was difficult to see how Claudia could make an error of this kind, but the priority was to reduce the pain. Chili is insoluble in water, so drinking from my bottle would not be effective. I advised him to find some oil. We headed back to the Japanese cafe and were not able to have any further conversation about Rosie. However, I had the basic information I needed. Jean had selected a woman without reference to the questionnaire. To see her again would be in total contradiction to the rationale for the wife project. Riding home, I reconsidered. I could see three reasons that it might be necessary to see Rosie again. One, good experimental design requires the use of a control group. It would be interesting to see Rosie as a benchmark to compare with women selected by the questionnaire. Two, the questionnaire had not produced any matches to date. I could interact with Rosie in the meantime. Three, as a geneticist with access to DNA analysis and the knowledge to interpret it, I was in a position to help Rosie find a biological father. Reasons one and two were invalid. Rosie was clearly not a suitable life partner. There was no point in interaction with someone so patently inappropriate, but reason three deserved consideration. Using my skills to assist her in a search for important knowledge aligned with my life purpose. I could do it in the time set aside for the wife project until a suitable candidate emerged. In order to proceed, I needed to re-establish contact with Rosie. I did not want to tell Jean that I planned to see her again so soon, after telling him that the probability of my doing so was zero. Fortunately, I recalled the name of the bar she worked at, the Marquis of Queensbury. There was only one bar of that name, in a back street of an inner suburb. I'd already modified the day's schedule, cancelling my market trip to catch up on the lost sleep. I would purchase a ready-made dinner instead. I'm sometimes accused of being inflexible, but I think this demonstrates an ability to adapt to even the strangest of circumstances. I arrived at 7:04 p.m., only to find that the bar did not open until 9 p.m. Incredible! No wonder people make mistakes at work. Would it be full of surgeons and flight controllers, drinking until after midnight, then working the next day? I ate dinner at a nearby Indian restaurant. By the time I'd worked my way through the buffet and returned to the bar, it was 9:27 p.m. There was a security official at the door, and I prepared myself for a repeat of the previous night. He examined me carefully, then asked, "Do you know what sort of place this is?" "I'm quite familiar with bars, perhaps even more familiar than most people. When I travel to conferences, I generally find a pleasant bar near my hotel and eat and drink there every evening." I replied in the affirmative and entered. I wondered if I'd come to the right location. The most obvious characteristic of Rosie was that she was female, and the patrons at the Marquis of Queensbury were without exception male. Many were wearing unusual costumes, and I took a few minutes to examine the range. Two men noted me looking at them, and one smiled broadly and nodded. I smiled back. It seemed to be a friendly place. But I was there to find Rosie. I walked to the bar. The two men followed and sat on either side of me. The clean-shaven one was wearing a cut-off T-shirt and clearly spent time at the gym. Steroids could also have been involved. The one with the moustache wore a leather costume and a black cap.
"I haven't seen you here before," said Black Cap.
I gave him the simple explanation.
"I haven't been here before. Can I buy you a drink?"
"You're offering to buy my drink." It was an unusual proposition from a stranger, and I guess that I would be expected to reciprocate in some way.
"I think that's what I said," said Black Cap. "What can we tempt you with?"
I told him that the flavour didn't matter as long as it contained alcohol. As in most social situations, I was nervous. Then Rosie appeared from the other side of the bar, dressed conventionally for her role in a collared black shirt. I was hugely relieved. I'd come to the correct place and she was on duty. Black Cap waved to her. He ordered three Budweisers. Then Rosie saw me.
"Don.
Greetings."
Rosie looked at us and asked, "Are you guys together?" "Give us a few minutes," said Steroid Man. Rosie said, "I think Don's here to see me."
"Correct."
"Well, pardon us interrupting your social life with drinks orders," Black Cap said to Rosie.
"You could use DNA, I said.
Rosie clearly didn't follow due to lack of context.
"What?"
"To identify your father. DNA is the obvious approach."
"Sure," said Rosie. "Obvious. Please send me your DNA so I can see if you're my father."
"Forget it. I was just mouthing off."
"You could collect it."
I wasn't sure how Rosie would respond to the next part of my suggestion. Surreptitiously. Rosie went silent. She was at least considering the idea, or perhaps wondering whether to report me. Her response supported the first possibility.
"And who's going to analyze it?"
"I'm a geneticist. You're saying if I got a sample, you could analyze it for me?"
"Trivial," I said. "How many samples do we need to test?"
"Probably only one. I've got a pretty good idea. He's a family friend."
Steroid Man coughed loudly and Rosie fetched two beers from the refrigerator. Black Cat put a $20 note on the counter, but Rosie pushed it back and waved them away. I tried the cough trick myself. Rosie took a moment to interpret the message this time, but then got me a beer.
"What do you need?" she asked, "to test the DNA?"
I explained that normally we would use scrapings from the inner cheek, but that it would be impractical to obtain these without the subject's knowledge. "Blood is excellent, but skin scrapings, mucus, urine..."
"Pass," said Rosie.
"Fecal material, semen..."
"Keeps getting better," said Rosie. "I can screw a 60-year-old family friend in the hope that he turns out to be my father." I was shocked.
"You'd have sex
Rosie explained that she was making a joke on such a serious matter. It was getting busy around the bar, and there were a lot of cough signals happening, an effective way to spread disease. Rosie wrote a telephone number on a piece of paper. Call me.
Chapter 10. The next morning, I returned with some relief to the routine that had been so severely disrupted over the past 2 days. My Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday runs to the market are a feature of my schedule, combining exercise, meal ingredients purchase, and an opportunity for reflection. I was in great need of the last of these. A woman had given me her phone number and told me to call her. More than the jacket incident, the balcony meal, and even the excitement of the potential father project, this had disrupted my world. I knew that it happened regularly. People in books, films, and TV shows do exactly what Rosie had done. But it had never happened to me. No woman had ever casually, unthinkingly, automatically written down her phone number, given it to me, and said, "Call me." I'd temporarily been included in a culture that I considered closed to me. Although it was entirely logical that Rosie should provide me with a means of contacting her, I had an irrational feeling that, when I called, Rosie would realize that she had made some kind of error. I arrived at the market and commenced purchasing. Because each day's ingredients are standard, I know which stalls to visit, and the vendors generally have my items pre-packaged in advance. I need only pay. The vendors know me well and are consistently friendly. However, it is not possible to timeshare major intellectual activity with the purchasing process due to the quantity of human and inanimate obstacles. Vegetable pieces on the ground, old ladies with shopping buggies, vendors still setting up stalls, Asian women comparing prices, goods being delivered, and tourists taking photos of each other in front of the produce. Fortunately, I'm usually the only jogger. On the way home, I resumed my analysis of the Rosie situation. I realized that my actions had been driven more by instinct than logic. There were plenty of people in need of help, many in more distress than Rosie, and numerous worthy scientific projects that would represent better use of my time than a quest to find one individual's father. And, of course, I should be giving priority to the wife project. Better to push Jean to select more suitable women from the list, or to relax some of the less important selection criteria, as I'd already done with the no drinking rule. The logical decision was to contact Rosie and explain that the father project was not a good idea. I phoned at 6:43 a.m. on returning from the run and left a message for her to call back. When I hung up, I was sweating despite the fact the morning was still cool. I hoped I wasn't developing a fever. Rosie called back while I was delivering a lecture. Normally, I turn my phone off at such times, but I was anxious to put this problem to bed. I was feeling stressed at the prospect of an interaction in which it was necessary for me to retract an offer. Speaking on the phone in front of a lecture theatre full of students was awkward, especially as I was wearing a lapel microphone. They could hear my side of the conversation. "Hi, Rosie."
"Don, I just want to say thanks for doing this thing for me. I didn't realize how much it had been eating me up. Do you know that little coffee shop across from the Commerce Building, Baristas? How about 2 o'clock tomorrow?"
Now that Rosie had accepted my offer of help, it would have been immoral and technically a breach of contract to withdraw it.
"Baristas, 2 p.m. tomorrow," I confirmed, though I was temporarily unable to access the schedule in my brain due to overload.
"You're a star," she said. Her tone indicated that this was the end of her contribution to the conversation. It was my turn to use a standard platitude to reciprocate, and the obvious one was the simple reflection of, "You're a star." But even I realized that made no sense. She was the beneficiary of my starness in the form of my genetics expertise. On reflection, I could have just said, "Goodbye," or "See you." But I had no time for reflection. There was considerable pressure to make a timely response.
"I like you too."
The entire lecture theatre exploded in applause. A female student in the front row said, "Smooth." She was smiling. Fortunately, I'm accustomed to creating amusement inadvertently. I did not feel too unhappy at failing to terminate the father project. The amount of work involved in one DNA test was trivial. We met at Barista's the next day at 2:07 p.m., Needless to say, the delay was Rosie's fault.
My students would be sitting in their 2:15 p.m. lecture waiting for my arrival. My intention had been only to advise her on the collection of a DNA sample, but she seemed unable to process instructions. In retrospect, I was probably offering too many options and too much technical detail too rapidly. With only 7 minutes to discuss the problem, allowing 1 minute for running to the lecture, we agreed that the simplest solution was to collect the sample together. We arrived at the residence of Dr. Eamon Hughes, the suspected father, on the Saturday afternoon. Rosie had telephoned in advance. Eamon looked older than I'd expected, I guessed 60, BMI 23. Eamon's wife, whose name was Belinda, approximately 55, BMI 28, made us coffee, as predicted by Rosie. This was critical, as we had decided that the coffee cup rim would be an ideal source of saliva. I sat beside Rosie, pretending to be her friend. Eamon and Belinda were opposite, and I was finding it hard to keep my eyes away from Eamon's cup. Fortunately, I was not required to make small talk. Eamon was a cardiologist, and we had a fascinating discussion about genetic markers for cardiac disease. Eamon finally finished his coffee, and Rosie stood up to take the cups to the kitchen. There, she would be able to swab the lip of the cup, and we would have an excellent sample. When we discussed the plan, I suggested that this would be a breach of social convention, but Rosie assured me that she knew Eamon and Belinda well as family friends, and as a younger person, she would be allowed to perform this chore. For once, my understanding of social convention proved more accurate, unfortunately. As Rosie picked up Belinda's cup, Belinda said, "Leave it, I'll do it later." Rosie responded, "No, please," and took Eamon's cup. Belinda picked up my cup and Rosie's and said, "Okay, give me a hand." They walked out to the kitchen together. It was obviously going to be difficult for Rosie to swab Eamon's cup with Belinda present, but I could not think of a way of getting Belinda out of the kitchen.
"Did Rosie tell you I studied medicine with her mother?" asked Eamon. I nodded. Had I been a psychologist, I might have been able to infer from Eamon's conversation and body language whether he was hiding the fact that he was Rosie's father. I might even have been able to lead the conversation in a direction to trap him. Fortunately, we were not relying on my skills in this arena. If Rosie succeeded in collecting the sample, I would be able to provide a far more reliable answer than one derived from observations of behaviour.
"If I can offer you a little encouragement," Eamon said, "Rosie's mother was a bit wild in her younger days. Very smart, good-looking. She could have had anyone. All the other women in medicine were going to marry doctors," he smiled. "But she surprised us all and picked the guy from left field who persisted and stuck around."
It was lucky I wasn't looking for clues. My expression must have conveyed my total lack of comprehension.
"I suspect Rosie may follow in her mother's footsteps," he said.
"In what component of her life?"
It seemed safer to seek clarification than assume that he meant getting pregnant to an unknown fellow student, or dying. These were the only facts I knew about Rosie's mother.
"I'm just saying I think you're probably good for her, and she's had a rough time. Tell me to mind my own business if you like. She's a great kid."
Now, the intent of the conversation was clear, although Rosie was surely too old to be referred to as a kid. Eamon thought I was Rosie's boyfriend. It was an understandable error. Correcting it would necessarily involve telling a lie, so I decided to remain silent. Then we heard the sound of breaking crockery. Eamon called out,
"Is everything okay?"
"Just broke a cup," said Belinda.
Breaking the cup was not part of the plan. Presumably, Rosie had dropped it in her nervousness or in trying to keep it from Belinda. I was annoyed at myself for not having a backup plan. I'd not treated this project as serious fieldwork. It was embarrassingly unprofessional, and it was now my responsibility to find a solution. It would surely involve deception, and I'm not skilled at deception. My best approach was to source the DNA for a legitimate reason.
"Have you heard about the Genographic Project?"
"No," said Eamon.
I explained that with a sample of his DNA, we could trace his distant ancestry. He was fascinated. I offered to have his DNA processed if he organized a cheek scraping and sent it to me.
Let's do it now, before I forget," he said. "Will blood do?"
"Blood is ideal for DNA testing, but..."
"I'm a doctor," he said. "Give me a minute."
Eamon left the room and I could hear Belinda and Rosie speaking in the kitchen. Belinda said,
"Seen your father at all?"
"Next question," said Rosie.
Belinda instead responded with a statement,
Dom seems nice.
Excellent. I was doing well.
Just a friend, said Rosie. If she knew how many friends I had, she might have realized what a great compliment she'd paid me.
Oh, well, said Belinda.